this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The attack on Chairman Omali Yeshitela and the Uhuru Movement is a continuation of the U.S. government and FBI's long history of war against the Black Freedom Movement.
A federal judge rejects Uhuru 3's motion to dismiss.
It is still the case that if Israel continues killing and harming civilians, destroying civilian infrastructure, blockading Gaza, denying humanitarian aid, using dehumanizing and inciting language, destroying evidence, or failing to report to the court, it will be in breach of the ICJ order.
The International Court of Justice rules against Israel's motion to dismiss the case of genocide in Gaza brought against Israel by South Africa.
Our job is not to stay elected. I think you stay elected when you do the right things. Our job is to tell people why it's unhealthy for you and your family to vote for such a, I mean, this man's a derelict.
Teamsters are outraged that IBT President Sean O'Brien invited former president and presidential candidate Donald Trump to speak at the union's national office.
We are organizing against our own leadership for prematurely ending the contract negotiations and giving us a fairly mediocre contract instead of a much more powerful contract that we could have had if we just kept striking.
California State University's statewide strike ends after one day and faculty speak out. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. We start with an update on the case of the Uhuru 3, three members of the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. A federal judge has rejected the motion to dismiss the case brought against them for allegedly conspiring with the Russian government to sow discord in the U.S. Here's a statement from Jesse Neville, chairman of Uhuru Solidarity Movement, working under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party to build white solidarity with Black Power and one of the Uhuru 3.
On Friday, January 26, 2024, the U.S. Magistrate Judge Anthony Porcelli in the Federal District Court of Tampa, Florida, filed an order recommending that District Judge William Young deny the motion for dismissal of the bogus charges against the Uhuru 3. The Uhuru 3 are Chairman Omali Yeshitela, 82-year-old founder and leader of the Uhuru Movement and Chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, along with Penny Hess and myself, Jesse Neville. Penny and I are white organizers who work for reparations to African people under the leadership of the Uhuru Movement. Last year, the U.S. federal government indicted the Uhuru 3 on the absurd charge that Chairman Omali Yeshitela and the Uhuru Movement's 50-year struggle for Black freedom had suddenly become a Russian-led conspiracy. The indictment came 9 months after the violent military-style multi-city FBI raids on seven homes and offices of the Uhuru Movement on July 29, 2022. The U.S. government's charges allege that Chairman Omali Yeshitela, who has fought for the liberation of African people for more than 60 years of his life, had somehow become an illegal Russian agent in 2014. In a conspiracy to sow discord in the United States. As Chairman Omali has stated, Black people in the United States do not need Russians or anyone else to tell them that they are being oppressed, facing genocidal violence in the form of mass incarceration, police terror and murder, infant and maternal mortality, gentrification, and colonial disparities in health, education, and housing. The attack on Chairman Omali Yeshitela and the Uhuru Movement is a continuation of the U.S. government and FBI's long history of war against the Black Freedom Movement that includes the notorious FBI infiltration, surveillance, and arrest of Marcus Garvey in the 1920s and the COINTELPRO program of the 1960s, which orchestrated the assassinations of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and over 30 members of the Black Panther Party. The Uhuru 3 attorney's motion for dismissal called for the baseless charges to be dismissed on the grounds that they violate the First Amendment right to freedom of speech. Everything the Uhuru 3 are alleged to have carried out are examples of political speech constitutionally protected by the First Amendment. The case is expected to go to trial later this year. Dates for the trial are expected to be set at a status hearing in February. The Uhuru Three each face a sentence of up to 15 years in federal prison. The Uhuru Three case has sparked the emergence of a global anti-colonial free speech movement led by the Hands Off Uhuru Fight Back Coalition. We call on everyone who believes in free speech and the right of the Black community to struggle for their liberation from colonial oppression to get involved in this campaign. You can learn more and donate to the Hands Off Uhuru Legal Defense Fund at handsoffuhuru.org/donate.
That was Jesse Neville, chair of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, speaking to Pacifica from St. Louis, Missouri. Listeners can learn more at handsoffuhuru.org. Kosaka Fantasy by Lala Kobis. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Last week, the International Court of Justice issued emergency orders that no act of genocide take place in Gaza and that Israel should take immediate and effective measures to address adverse conditions to life in the Gaza Strip. The court ruled against Israel's claim that South Africa could not demonstrate that Israel committed genocide in Gaza and denied Israel's motion to dismiss the case. Pacifica's Don DeBar has more.
The court considers that the civilian population in the Gaza Strip remains extremely vulnerable.
That was Judge Joan E. Donahue, president of the International Court of Justice, as she read the court's order Friday in reply to an application by South Africa for provisional measures to force Israel to stop its war on Gaza until the underlying case charging Israel with genocide can be heard by the court.
It recalls that the military operation conducted by Israel after 7 October 2023 has resulted inter alia in tens of thousands of deaths and injuries and the destruction of homes, schools, medical facilities, and other vital infrastructure, as well as displacement on a massive scale. The court notes that the operation is ongoing and that the Prime Minister of Israel announced on 18 January 2024 that the war, I quote, will take many more long months, end of quote. At present, many Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have no access to the most basic foodstuffs, potable water, electricity, essential medicines, or heating. The World Health Organization has estimated that 15% of the women giving birth in Gaza Strip are likely to experience complications and indicates that maternal and newborn death rates are expected to increase due to the lack of access to medical care. In these circumstances, the court considers that the catastrophic humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is at serious risk of deteriorating further before the court renders its final judgment.
The judges ordered Israel to not kill any civilians in Gaza and to not commit a number of other acts that violate the genocide law, but it stopped short of imposing a complete stop to military action in Gaza. The court did deny Israel's attempt to have the case dismissed. In a press conference immediately after the order was released, South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, spoke with reporters.
This case was very much about international bodies ensuring that they exercise their responsibility to protect us all as global citizens. All member states of the United Nations have attached their signatures to a range of instruments. But when lives are threatened, these instruments are not brought to bear. And South Africa had the view that we could not stand idly by and continue to observe the killing, of thousands of Palestinian citizens who had no role in the awful act of hostage taking and killing that was done by Hamas. And therefore, we thought it important that we do report and apply to the International Court of Justice that the measures provided within the Convention for the Punishment and Prevention of Genocide are brought to bear, and that the State of Israel is called upon by the judges to act to protect civilians and to end the massive level of harm that we have seen since the Israeli action began. And we agree entirely with the judges that Hamas should release the hostages that they're currently holding. We also, in our various engagements with our partners internationally, believe the moment is now ripe for there to be negotiations for a two-state solution to end this conflict decisively.
Minister, are you disappointed there isn't a ceasefire? Are you disappointed the court called for a ceasefire?
I believe that in exercising the order, there would have to be a ceasefire. Without it, the order doesn't actually work. I would have wanted a ceasefire.
They didn't specifically call for a ceasefire.
No, they didn't.
Are you disappointed that they didn't specify that?
I have no way that I'm going to say I'm disappointed. I hoped for it, but the fact of delivering humanitarian aid, the fact of taking measures that reduce the levels of harm against persons who have no role in what Israel is combating, for me, requires a ceasefire. And I believe Israel would have to attend to how it conducts its search for the hostages and for those Hamas individuals who carried out the October 7th attack.
Well, to try to make sense out of all of that, we speak with Christopher Black, who's an attorney who's practiced in front of the ICC, and we've spoken with him before about this case, which is before the ICJ. Chris, your thoughts on first blush looking at this decision?
It's a display of blatant display of double standards, because on March 16, 2022, when Ukraine made a complaint similar to the South Africa complaint against Israel, against Russia, the court quite quickly issued an order compelling Russia to withdraw its forces from Ukraine and stop its operations. At a point when no civilians had been killed on anybody's account at that point in March of 2022. And yet, when the whole world sees Israel committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza, and when the court recites evidence that South Africa presented to them in its decision, which are compelling evidence that that's still going on, did not make an order that the South Africans requested for a ceasefire and for them to withdraw their forces. They just said, you can keep the war going and basically just behave yourselves, boys. That's all they did. So they basically gave a green light for those operations to continue. And the South Africans claim that's a victory, that they made this order compelling Israel to obey the Geneva Conventions, but Israel already states that it's doing that. It is somewhat of a success that Israel has been told that there is maybe a plausible case that they're committing genocide, which will be heard later on and sometime in the future in the court when the substantive case is argued. That's some accomplishment, but it doesn't do anything to stop the operations that Israel is committing, and doesn't make or require Israel to stop those operations yet. As we saw just 18 months ago, Russia was ordered to stop its operations by the same court. So the display of double standards is quite clear.
We have a 29-page document. And when the court is getting to the point after reciting the history and its position on various issues, that in essence that the litigation is going to go forward, that there is a plausible case and other things, before it actually gets to the meat of the determination, it throws in this statement about the hostages, as they're termed, the people that are being held prisoner by Hamas. It is gravely concerned about the fate of the hostages abducted during the attack in Israel on 7 October 2023 and held since then by Hamas and other armed groups, and calls for their immediate and unconditional release.
Right.
There's nothing comparable
to, let's say, first of all, being gravely concerned about the, was it 30,000 people that have been killed now in the last 3.5 months, and particularly 10 or 12 or 15,000 children. And then, of course, if you want to term these people hostages, what do you term all those people that are in Israeli jails? And how many are there?
Oh, estimates go from 15 to 20,000, and including many thousands of children, and some born in prison to women being held there without charge or without conviction, and being basically held hostage for many years. And the court didn't mention them at all. And yet that's one of the reasons that Hamas acted. I mean, that's just ignored.
I mean, this is something that's been going on, right? Trading hostages, so to speak. It's so out of scale. You've got, again, 10 or 15,000 people on one side, and I don't know how many are left in supposedly in Hamas's custody. 50,
maybe 100, maybe 150 left. I think half have been released, but I think they still have. I think it's around 150, something like that.
So it's like 100 to 1 in this.
Yes, 100 to 1, and they implicitly accepted the Israeli argument that they're acting in self-defense when the court should have stated quite clearly, in accordance with UN resolutions and the ICC decision, and even one of their own decisions, that Israel has no right of self-defense against the Hamas operation on October 7th, because Hamas was acting as a legitimate resistance group, attacking the military forces of an occupying power, occupying its lands, their lands. Israel has no right of self-defense against such a military action. Their only legal option is to withdraw their forces from the occupied territories. Yet the court ignored that and implicitly accepted that Israel has the right to self-defense, therefore can continue the operation, when they should have said Israel has no right to continue this operation or even begin this operation. That was never said.
Yeah. Now the underlying case goes forward. Is that?
Yeah. The basic substantive case about whether Israel has committed genocide or not, and on the evidence, will be heard at some future date unknown to us, months or maybe even years in the future, but well after this war is concluded, probably.
And before they exhaust the bodies of every, you know, remaining person in Gaza, there's this, in essence, a 30-day reprieve on the injunctive relief. They're supposed to submit some kind of a report showing how they've stopped doing whatever bad things they might have been doing that they haven't really been found to be doing by the court.
Exactly. It's sort of Alice in Wonderland. So Israel may never file such a report, or it'll get lost in the bureaucracy of the ICJ or the UN somewhere, or they may file a report claiming that they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. But that won't probably be filed in evidence until the substantive hearing takes place, whenever that does.
That was attorney and international law expert Christopher Black speaking to Pacifica's Don DeBar. Craig Mochaber is the former director of the New York office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who resigned over the UN's inaction to stop Israeli genocide in Gaza. He spoke to Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate of The Gray Zone, expressing a far more favorable and optimistic view of the ICJ ruling.
Well, I mean, I've seen all the debate happening on Twitter. I have to say, for me, this is an absolutely historic victory for Palestine and for South Africa, and for the world in many ways, because it is the first really significant crack in Israeli impunity that we have seen for decades and decades, maybe ever. You had an almost unanimous court decision, almost unanimous because, of course, there was an Israeli ad hoc judge who was there, who, by the way, didn't vote no on everything. And then a very strange dissent from the Ugandan judge. But every other judge on the court voted that South Africa had made a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide, and the court ordered Israel to stop all of the related actions. The so-called provisional measures included a call, not just for Israel to take some reasonable measures or some measures, but to take all measures within its power. This is quite a strong ruling, to immediately stop the killing and the harming of people in Gaza, inflicting destructive conditions on them, to punish incitement, to allow humanitarian aid, that means ending the siege, to preserve evidence, and to report to the court within 1 month. So the state of Israel is under the supervision of the World Court. So for me, this is really significant. It's going to be very important in empowering states and regional organizations and civil society groups and movements and activists to mobilize, to bring more pressure to bear to actually change the situation on the ground. And I know there's a big debate on whether the word ceasefire should have appeared here. I don't think it makes that much of a difference, because whether or not there is a ceasefire language in the decision, it is still the case that if Israel continues killing and harming civilians, destroying civilian infrastructure, blockading Gaza, denying humanitarian aid, using dehumanizing and inciting language, destroying evidence, or failing to report to the court, it will be in breach of the ICJ order. And I think that's very significant.
So respond to the critics of the order, including several prominent Palestinian journalists who've been covering this genocide for over 100 days, who have slammed the court for its failure to order a ceasefire.
Well, of course, we all want a ceasefire. And that's been one of the principal goals from day one, and that remains a goal. But, you know, in my sense, what the court has done without using the word ceasefire is it has ordered that kind of action, because you cannot, there is no conceivable universe in which you could implement the orders of the court and still continue to bombard Gaza, right? You know, you could make an argument that Israel retains the space and the right to repel attacks, but to continue what it's been doing over the course of these 3+ months, that would clearly be in violation. How can you have meaningful delivery of humanitarian aid? The UN has said over and over again, what is preventing the distribution of humanitarian aid principally is that the attacks are continuing. You know, how can you stop the killing of Palestinian civilians or doing serious mental and physical harm to them, which is a part of this order as well from the Genocide Convention, if you don't stop the attacks? You cannot. That would be impossible. So it doesn't take a lawyer to identify a breach in what the court has ordered if Israel were to continue these activities. The other thing I would say about that, Max, is that some of those who are trying to emphasize the ceasefire language most of all are those who support the genocide in Gaza. A lot of corporate media outlets in the West, in the U.S. and in the West, are trying to report on this by saying the court didn't order a ceasefire, therefore, you know, basically Israel is one. And we have to think about their motives, right? These are media outlets that have worked very hard to maintain an information brownout in the U.S. and in the West about genocide. And many of them have been actively disseminating Israeli propaganda, dehumanizing language against Palestinians, actual incitement to genocide, justification of war crimes in their reporting. So now they're trying like crazy to downplay how badly Israel has lost this stage of the proceedings by focusing on that ceasefire question. I think that's a disingenuous analysis on their part, and I think it's not a very good analysis by those who are focusing on it here. That said, I'll just repeat again, we all want to ceasefire. I think this decision helps us to move toward that direction.
So Netanyahu has said that no matter what the court does, no one can stop Israel from going all the way towards victory. The U.S., of course, will ignore this as well. They were asked, I think, in this State Department briefing yesterday, they said they were asked if they would obey the ruling, and they kind of refused to answer the question. My boy Vedant Patel. So let's talk about enforcement mechanisms. I mean, when Israel predictably ignores this call for them to cease genocidal practices in the Gaza Strip, what can be done to enforce this ruling? And specifically, is Yemen's military acting to, I mean, does this ruling help legitimize what Yemen's military is doing to stop the genocide?
Well, I've been saying all along that the two states that have taken concrete effort to meet their international obligations to prevent and fight against genocide are South Africa and Yemen, the Houthis in Yemen. And I still think that is true. And I'm not surprised by the U.S. hesitant to commit itself. The U.S., has had rulings against it in the International Court of Justice, the mining of the harbors in Nicaragua, that it completely ignored and continued to violate international law. And of course, Israel has had rulings against it, the advisory opinion on the apartheid wall in the West Bank that it has refused to implement, and that the U.S. has defended it in its impunity in that case. So these are the kinds of reactions we expect from states that don't respect international law. The pressure on the rest of the international community, of other states, it seems to me, is where it's really important. It's going to be harder and harder, for example, to have a genocidal wall maintained in Europe across the board. I think you are going to increasingly see states there feeling compelled to go along with the ruling of the court and to say things appropriately. You've already had a lot of dissent expressed by some European courts, some European countries, like Ireland, obviously, you know, is a lot of dissent, but Slovenia and Spain and some others. I think you're going to see
Finland. We just saw Finland's foreign minister say, "Hey, we've reached the limit of dead Palestinian babies."
Right. So I think you're going to see more and more of that, and it's going to be harder for Europe to maintain this pro-genocide line that they have so shamefully, you know, held on to since the beginning of the onslaught. I think you're going to see this as an encouragement to other states in the global South to be standing up. And my hope is that, I mean, we know what the next step is going to be. Israel is either going to say it will not comply or not comply, say it's going to comply and not do so. Whether or not they will be within a month back at the court to provide the mandated report, I don't know. But either way, the court is going to be compelled to act again when it receives reports that these things are not being implemented. And then the court relies on the Security Council for enforcement in the first instance. The U.S. will veto. Well, I suspect the U.S. will veto, again, any action to compel that. Some people think the U.S. might abstain. I think that would be extraordinary under a Biden presidency. I think they're still most likely to veto. When that happens, and in some ways that may be a good thing, because you might actually get a stronger resolution in the General Assembly. So when the Security Council fails, it goes to the General Assembly under the Uniting for Peace resolution and an emergency special session, where the General Assembly, whether you have one country, one vote, could come together, and there they could do one of two things. Either they could adopt a resolution that just condemns Israel and doesn't have any meat to it, which would be terrible, but it could do something else. It could adopt a resolution that asked states to take certain concrete measures that relate to sanctioning Israel, you know, through diplomatic and consular action, economic action, political action. It could encourage states to take individual criminal cases under universal jurisdiction against Israeli perpetrators. It could call for the non-recognition of Israeli travel documents. It could set up a tribunal. It could set up mechanisms, as it did during apartheid in South Africa, to bring more pressure to bear and to mobilize the international community against the perpetrating regime. There are a lot of concrete things that could be in a resolution like that. Now, what you can bet would be happening behind the scenes is the U.S. and its allies would use all their carrots and sticks to browbeat countries of the South to not vote in favor of that resolution and to try to water it down into something that just condemns and doesn't have any of those measures. Even in that case, you know, this is a crime of universal jurisdiction. The court has underscored again that the obligations we're talking about here are obligations erga omnes partes, which means those obligations are on every state that's a party to the convention. In fact, under customary international law for genocide, even those that haven't ratified the convention have those obligations. And that means any of them, individually or collectively, are responsible to take measures to try to give effect to this in whatever ways they can, individual criminal cases, relations, weapons sales, technology exchanges, all of these things could be really meaningful. And of course, when the movement to try to hold South Africa accountable for apartheid began, there are very few states involved in that, frontline states and a few others, and that grew and grew and grew. And it's that momentum I think we rely on. And then the last thing I'll say is, this is very powerful for global society, for movements, for labor unions, for civil society actors, activists and others. This is going to be a huge tool in the toolkit of pushing back from global civil society that can be turned into pressure against governments then, including governments in the West, to do the right thing. So I think, again, I'll finish where I started on this. It's a historic day, and it is a real crack in Israel's impunity.
That was former UN official Craig Mulkiber speaking on the Gray Zone live stream last Friday. Human rights and labor lawyer Dan Kovalik recently discussed a new document from Hamas replying to the Israeli claims about October 7th, which portrays a very different picture of that day and of Hamas as well.
So today I want to talk about a very interesting statement that Hamas has put out, a 17-page response to Israel about the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood operations that Hamas carried out in Israel. It's a very interesting document. And it's not getting any attention, of course, in the mainstream Western press. A couple of the salient points that Hamas makes is one, and again, this is very much contrary to what you're going to hear in the Western press. Hamas makes it clear that its issue is with the Israeli occupation and oppression of the Palestinians, not with the Jewish people. And they make it clear that they do not have anti-Jewish hatred, that their issue is with Israel and Zionism. Not with the Jews. They acknowledge the occurrence and terrible nature of the Holocaust. And so that's, first of all, an important caveat. And along with that, what goes hand in hand with that is Hamas said that their targets on October 7th were not Israeli civilians. They were military targets. That was their main goal, was military. They're saying that a lot of the civilians killed that day were in fact killed by the Israeli soldiers themselves, who were under the Hannibal directive, which was to kill people to prevent them from being hostages. The Hamas has categorically denied raping people that day, as has been claimed. And actually, they're calling for a full independent investigation of what happened, because they believe that that would exonerate them from some of certainly the worst claims that Israel has made against them. So this is a very important document. It needs to be looked at and considered, and it helps to paint a fuller picture of October 7th and what we're seeing right now in Gaza.
That was human rights and labor lawyer Dan Kovalik. That was legendary guitarist Eric Clapton, Got to Get Better in a Little While, part of his performance title To Save a Child in Aid of the Children of Gaza, broadcast live on January 17, 2024. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. Teamsters were outraged that Teamsters President Sean O'Brien invited former President Donald Trump to speak at the union's national office. I spoke with Teamsters Vice President John Palmer from Texas and Teamsters 808 Local Secretary Treasurer Chris Silvera from New York. And we've covered the struggle in the Teamsters Union around the issue of Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters Union, having a private meeting with former President Trump at Mar-a-Lago and keeping it secret from the membership. And the latest development is that Sean O'Brien, the president, has invited Trump to the Teamsters office, and he's going to be meeting there on the 30th. There are Teamsters around the country who are really seriously questioning and challenging whether this is the direction the Teamsters should go. And one of them is John Palmer, who is an international vice president of the Teamsters. And he raised the, at first when Sean O'Brien met with Trump, raised that issue, and he's continued to raise it in a recent letter that he wrote and statement when Sean O'Brien ordered all Teamster executive board members to attend this meeting with Trump. So welcome to the show.
Good to be back.
So John, you originally raised this issue of why would your president, Sean O'Brien, be meeting with Trump? And now you learned this week that, in fact, he's invited Trump to the headquarters of the Teamsters this coming Tuesday. Were you surprised by that?
I'd like to say I was. I was more surprised at the memo that was sent to me and the rest of the General Executive Board demanding our attendance. And, you know, ironically, the Constitution has language, which I think goes back to the 50s when we had the Red Scare. But anyway, the language that says that, you know, you can't associate with criminal elements or people that are involved in trying to overthrow a federal, state, or province, provincial government. So I responded by saying I wouldn't come to that meeting. Now, he's going to meet with Joe Biden in the afternoon after he meets with Trump, and I will attend that meeting. I do believe he constitutionally, I shouldn't meet with him because it's you can be barred from membership in the union, but take it a step further. I have a problem with the morals and principles or lack thereof of former President Trump, who God help us all should remain former.
And Sean Fain at the UAW convention did go through some of his labor record where he crossed picket lines, IASI picket lines. He went to a non-union plant during the GM strike and told the workers basically they shouldn't support their union from a right-wing position, not from a criticism of the union from the left. And also, Sean Fain said that Trump was a scab.
Donald Trump is a scab. Donald Trump is a billionaire, and that's who he represents. If Donald Trump ever worked in an auto plant, he wouldn't be a UAW member. He'd be a company man trying to squeeze the American worker.
The question is why, if that's the case, would Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters Union, invite a scab to be interviewed about whether or not the Teamsters should support him?
Well, the argument they're making is we have to talk to all the candidates. He's one of the candidates. And in a normal world, which I think leftists 7 years ago, I would say that argument has some value, but there's a very common adage that's going around right now that says when people tell you who they are, you should believe them. If you keep up with anything, you know, current, you I mean, there's a mountain of things that this man has done, and you know, against labor, but against humanity as well. I mean, here lies the problem, and I have my own theory because I'm. You know, I don't, people don't tell me what they think. That's a problem of politics. They don't really tell you what they think. But my theory is that, first of all, these people make a lot of money. They all get 2 and 3 salaries, and so in some cases, 4 salaries for their positions. There's plenty of them making close to 300 or at 300,000 a year. There are locals where they make even more than that. Some people who can't work for the international because the guy running the Amazon campaign can't work for the international. He makes more money than a general president. But the point here is when you're a rank and file member and you're a leader and you're not shopping in the same places, you're not eating in the same places, all you spend more time with the company than you do your members. And that's what the union busters go after us with is this top-down leadership. And that structure doesn't work. And the reason we're, you know, our members feel a disconnect. And, you know, they were sold a contract at UPS. And now I think the majority of the members realize that's what happened to them. They're very disconnected. I don't think Sean wants to offend. I believe the internal polls tell us that 50%+ of the people in the Teamsters vote either Republican or including Trump, some cases. And they're playing that delicate dance of trying to be all things to all people. Our job is not to stay elected. I think you stay elected when you do the right things. Our job is to tell people why it's unhealthy for you and your family to vote for such a, I mean, this man's a derelict.
And the rise of fascism, I know that Trump is supporting Milei in Argentina. He, Javier Milei, has passed laws to, he wants to pass laws to outlaw unions, basically, privatize the economy, and also prevent workers, more than three people, from meeting. I mean, he's setting up a dictatorship, a fascist dictatorship. And Trump said he would get rid of the Constitution on his first day. The yeah. rise of fascism in this country, there hasn't been a debate in the labor movement. I know that the Vermont AFL-CIO in 2016 said there should be a general strike against any attempted coup or insurrection in this country. It seems that that Sean O'Brien is not concerned about the danger of fascism and the danger of a dictatorship in the United States.
Sean O'Brien's concerned with being the reelected greatest ever Teamster president. So he wants to stay in office. But to the fascism issue, yeah. I mean, the other day, Trump told people that Viktor Orban was a guy that he looked up to.
I also spoke with Chris Silvera, executive secretary of IBT Local 808, about his reaction to the proposed visit of Donald Trump to the International Brotherhood of Teamsters headquarters.
We're not dealing with the Republican Party anymore. I think people should be very clear about this, that this is either the Trumplicans, if they want to call them that, or they're Confederates, which means that they're no longer a part of what we understand America to be. And so to have this meeting, didn't have any other secret meetings. When I say secret meetings, he didn't have to go to Asa Hutchinson's home, or he didn't have to go to Nikki Haley's home, or didn't have to go to Biden's home. You know, so why did you have to go to Mar-a-Lago to precede the public meeting? There's something funny about that. And this is, Mar-a-Lago is the place where people go to bow down. You know, Speaker of the House McCarthy and so many others who have all made that trip to Mar-a-Lago. None of them went down there to raise hell. All of them went down there to kiss the ring of Donald Trump. And so therefore, one can see that there is something improper with our leader, our general president, making this trip to the headquarters of the Confederacy.
And the growth of racism in this country, a fascist movement growing, Trump's open racist attacks on blacks, on brown people, on immigrants, on Muslims. What does that say that the IBT would even consider endorsing somebody like that?
Well, I mean, the mere fact that we would even consider it, right, is an affront to all those other members who are not a party to this fascist movement that's taking place, this reemergence of the lost cause babies. It actually sends a message to all the non-white, the women members of our union, that you really don't care anything about them, that you're worrying about what racist elements within our union think. So instead of trying to either A, convert those racist elements over to a newfound reality, or B, isolate them and just says, listen, you know, you're here, you could leave when you feel like. But to really believe that we had to play with them at this moment in history is troubling, to say the least. Board members should have advised our general president that this was not an appropriate action to take, right? I am presuming that most of them are not business unionists and that they're trade unionists and movement people, that they would be offended, that the women that were on the board were offended, that the Latinos on the board were offended, that the Blacks on the board were offended, and that they would have arranged some kind of a boycott.
That was International Brotherhood of Teamsters Vice President John Palmer and IBT 808 Secretary Treasurer Chris Silvera on Donald Trump's upcoming visit to their national office in Washington, D.C. Was Chumbawamba One by One. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. 29,000 faculty and counselors went out on strike last week at the California State University System on what was supposed to be a five-day strike. However, union leaders called it off after one day without most of their demands being met, including a 12% wage increase. Strikers talked about the reasons for the strike and the betrayal.
I'm James Martell. I'm the former chapter president of the CFA San Francisco State Chapter, and I am on the executive board right now and a professor of political science. It's not exactly a wildcat strike, but it's a wildcat strike in spirit at least, because we are organizing against our own leadership for prematurely ending the contract negotiations and giving us a fairly mediocre contract instead of a much more powerful contract that we could have had if we just kept striking. I think that in a way, I think they're just like used to being like a top-down union. It's kind of the culture of the place, and we did introduce open bargaining this year for the first time, which was a real game changer, and I think they just got scared of our power and kind of made a deal. The irony of all this is that the CSU is sitting on $14 billion, and they put away $1 billion in profit a year. I always say that the CSU is now a private corporation with a side gig as a public university, and they're increasingly uninterested in education. Basically, they've given up on the public sector entirely. They don't think of it as a good investment. They think of it as an investment, and if you think of it that way, you're thinking in capitalist terms, and that's not what public education is about. This place should be free. They raise student tuition by 30% over the next 6 years. People can't afford this already, so they're just going to put us into like this death spiral. They just don't care about public education anymore. Ironically, even from a capitalist perspective, this is an amazing investment. They put a little bit of money into these students. They go out, they make, you know, they have great careers, but they don't think that way. They just think all this short-term, profit-oriented. It's as if they had stockholders, even though they don't. I mean, when we started with open bargaining, it was wonderful. They were really cool. They, like, at one point, the administrators came and they freaked out at how many people were in the room, and they said, is this going to be this many people? And one of the leaders of the bargaining team said, no, there might be up to 30,000 people, because everyone on the membership is on the bargaining team. That was beautiful, but unfortunately, over time, it got more and more restricted. So by the end, they weren't bargaining. It wasn't open bargaining anymore. A tiny handful of the leadership. I think probably Kevin Weir, who's like the head of the bargaining team, and maybe a few other people. It was a small handful of people. They made a deal, and then they tried to sell it to us, and we're not having it. I think what we should do is change the internal structure of the union, so we have direct election of bargaining team members and the president and all that, and sort of make it a more democratic institution. At this campus, they fired 350 lecturers because of enrollment issues. So if they're going to make the enrollment crisis worse, then that's not helping. So
are they going to get their jobs back as a result of this contract?
I don't think so. No.
So they basically abandoned these people. They're gone.
Yeah, they've abandoned. Like we used to have like 1,500 faculty. Now we have 1,200. Yeah, it was rough. And you know, all of our classes are huge now, and there's like the students can't get into any electives, and it's terrible. And honestly, I think in some ways we're being punished for being one of the most out there campuses, one of the best organized campuses. So I think that it's not a coincidence that we're the ones that suffered the most and had this huge cut. Well, I'll tell you, this is only a rumor. I don't know if this is true, but the rumor is that the Democrats, and especially Gavin Newsom, reached out and created this bad deal because they wanted to create labor peace so they could focus on their primaries and all their stuff. They've never been a friend of labor, and they continue not to be a friend of labor.
Marla Lowenthal. Today, the teachers and staff are trying to fight for a living wage. And what they're offering us is absolutely ridiculous. I've taught at many schools, and this is the worst salary of any school I've ever taught at. And this is really pathetic. And just learning from some of my colleagues today that they're even making worse than I am. Ridiculous. Cost of living is outlandish, and they're not giving us a living wage. 5%, forget the cost of living. I mean, you can't live off this. This is seriously, other schools, I'm making $5,000 more than I make here. Same material, same class, same number of hours. And this is horrible the way. Plus, the number of students here is horrible. And then I just found out today that they don't have services to support them. We all thought they had counseling services. So we have a kid who's got a problem, or you know, so they don't even have counseling services. And they were pushing to have one counselor for 1,500 students. This is outlandish. I mean, I didn't know that. We all have kids who've got emotional problems. I mean, and, you know, I mean, all of us have kids who need help. And we kept sending them over to counseling services. Now we learned that there aren't any. And I've tried to help my students. And, you know, we keep hearing the kids coming out of COVID. Well, we're getting them as freshmen, sophomores, you know, and they do need help.
The local chapter is, the leaders are right on it. It's the board that stepped in and facilitated this so-called tentative agreement on Monday, and without consulting any of the local leadership. Basically speaking, overall, the constituency here, and we're hearing at several other campuses, are not happy with the tentative agreement. It doesn't really make changes, especially for adjuncts like myself. I'm here now, and I've been here for quite a while, and I'm at a point where I'd like to just be set at one place. I'm a senior now. And I'm at my, you know, I have a Master of Arts degree. I have a teaching credential that takes me through from kindergarten through sophomore level, university level. And I'm still at the very pretty base level. And so this upping of the $3,000 increase to range for what we call a step level up really doesn't affect many of us, because you have to be at the very bottom round of the pay scale. And I'm like about $500 to $700 above that. That $3,000 I would not get. Saying living wages throughout state of California, obviously that's a big issue across many industries, but we are the lowest paid in terms of, from my understanding, even across many of the other CSU campuses. San Francisco State faculty are paid very low. And I worked at a community college and I made about 40% more salary than I make here. And so I'm grateful to be here, and I can get by, but there's so many in the younger faculty. We laid off 300 people. And unfortunately, the administration, they all got a 12 to 29% increase. And we're fighting, we're asking for 12%. That's what we're asking for a 12% raise. And we're asking to raise the bottom cap, salary cap, by $10,000. And then all of a sudden we hear, oh, it's going to be 5% for this year, retroactive to July. We had to fight for that. And then 5% again, maybe. But it's tied to the state budget, and the budget where the state is losing money.
Those were the voices of striking faculty at San Francisco State University after a strike cut short without most of their demands being met. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Polina Vasiliev and myself, Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening.